Welcome to 2819. This is the show where we aim to inspire you to go and make disciples of all nations. I'm Sandra Dimes.
And I'm Krista Bontrager, and this is the television outreach of Reasons to Believe, a viewer-supported ministry where science and faith converge.
And you know, we hope that as you're watching, you'll just take some of what you're hearing today, and it'll really help you to step out and share your faith with others.
And also, as you're watching today, be sure to take a moment to get connected with us on social media. You'll find some pretty fun posts that Sandra and I are putting there on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at 2819 Show.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. But first, we're going to do a quick rundown of what you can expect on today's show. So in our Nexus segment, RTB visiting scholar Ken Keithley will discuss the question, do the creation accounts in Genesis 1 and 2 contradict each other?
That's a very common question, not just among non-believers. Also, Christians have that question as well. Then in Culture Talk, Sandra and Hugh will talk about the soulishness of animals. And I hear you have two very special guests.
I do. They're kind of small, but we'll have to wait for that. But in our Give and Take segment, Jeff will talk about the question, if the heavens declare the glory of God, then why are there so many scientists who are atheists? Buzz and AJ will join him for that conversation.
Now, those of you who caught the show last week, Jeff talked about that same question, but with our philosophers.
Yep.
So now we're going to tackle it from a scientific point of view. I can't wait to hear that discussion. And then in our RTB News segment, Monica and I are going to talk again about RTB's student mentoring program called The Lab.
But first up in RTB 101, Krista, you're going to be talking with Ken Samples about a question many of us might wonder. Why are there so many Bible translations? So many.
So many.
Let's take a look.
Now it's time for RTB 101. This is the segment where we talk about practical questions to help equip you to share your faith with your friends and family more effectively. And I'm here again with my colleague and fellow theologian, Kenneth Samples. Ken, we're going to talk about Bible translations.
Yes.
There are so, so many. And more coming out all the time,
right.
It seems. In the old days when we used to have Christian bookstores, which seems to have gone the way of the dinosaurs to some regard.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, you got just a whole wall of different translations. But I know that this can be a source of confusion among unbelievers, and especially my Muslim and LDS friends. Why are there so many translations? Why can't Christians get their act together and have just one?
It's an important question. I think the way of thinking about this issue is to realize that if you look at all of these Bibles, if you look at all of these translations, they're very, very, very similar. And there are times where there's a particular thought in mind in some of these translations, like a paraphrase, maybe the Living Bible. You want something that is very, very readable. It may not be the best translation in the world in a scholarly way, but it's intended to get people, whet their appetite, get them involved. Other times, Krista, translators are thinking, I'm going to translate this word for word, whereas other times they'll say, no, let's try to capture the thought. So I think it's important to recognize that if we go back to the 3rd and 4th century, compare those manuscripts with what we have today, there's no major changes.
Okay.
So it's the same Bible, but there are different emphases with the Living Bible, the NIV, the NASB, etc.
So when I'm trying to make sense of the Bible translation alphabet soup that's out there,
yes.
So some principles it sounds like I need to know, first of all, is that the manuscripts that stand under the translations, the original languages of
3rd, 4th century,
Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic, those things are pretty well established.
Very well.
What we're talking about is the English expression of those manuscripts, right? And then I think what I hear you say is we might think of them as different buckets, like three different buckets. We have some Bible translations that are word for word. They try to be as
very literal.
Very literal. Okay. Then we have another bucket of kind of how do I express the main thoughts or ideas?
NIV, a good example of that.
Okay. And then we have paraphrase Bibles that are more of like how do I put it in more contemporary language?
That's right. That's exactly right. Now, if you look at them, they're all faithful. If you look at them, they all correspond to the ancient manuscripts. So unlike the claim made by the Muslims and the Mormons, there is no translation that is corrupted or anything like that.
Yeah, because I think that is a point of confusion among many people is, well, don't all these Bible translations prove that the Bible's been corrupted? But really, I think what I hear you saying is we've got to look a little deeper at the manuscripts, and that's the stable part.
Yes, and again, we can go back many centuries, and unlike other so-called holy books, there's no major corruption.
Okay, so when we think about Bible translations, tell me what your favorite is. Which one do you like
well,
to use?
Well, I know a little Greek and a little Hebrew. I like a Bible that will use the biblical languages. I like study Bibles because I like information at my fingertips. I like the 1984 NIV. I like the ESV, the English Standard Version. There are a lot of good ones. You know, the King James Bible is a very good translation.
Yeah.
So we actually have the opposite problem to people in the ancient world. We have an abundance of good Bible translations.
I know one of my favorites. I too like the NIV. I've kind of been transitioning to 2011, but my standard teaching Bible is the 1984 version.
Yes.
I've also discovered recently the New Living Translation. My husband and I use that in our devotions together.
Oh, interesting.
Very refreshing. Really like that, especially for new believers. It's
a little simpler.
But Kenneth Samples, everyone, I want to invite you to check out his blog called Reflections. It's at reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com. So many thoughtful pieces there. Thank you for all that you do to sow into us and help us grow. Next up, our Nexus segment, we're going to hear from our visiting scholar, Dr. Ken Keithley. And he's going to address a very common question asked by many people. Are Genesis 1 and 2 actually two different creation accounts that contradict each other? Let's check that out right now.
Ken, I oftentimes hear skeptics say that Genesis 1 and 2 are two separate creation accounts that actually contradict each other. How can I respond to that?
Yeah, I hear that too, where they'll say that it looked like it was just two borrowed myths that were cobbled together very poorly, and it's a sort of a Frankenstein stitched together. And one would read that or hear that taught a lot 100 years ago. One doesn't hear that today. In fact, when you look very carefully at the Genesis text, and we let the author himself divide it, what we find is that the book of Genesis has 10 chapters, and it has a Toledot formula. These are the generations of, or this is the history of. And we find that in 10 different sections throughout the book of Genesis. And where do we find the first one? In Genesis 2, the beginning there, Genesis 2, 4, and 5. So if we were going to say, where does the first chapter of Genesis begin? It begins in Genesis 2, 4, and 5. So that is the creation account. Well, then, what is Genesis 1? It's recognized across the board among Old Testament scholars that Genesis 1 is a prologue. It is a preliminary. It operates much the way John 1, the first 18 verses of John chapter 1, operates in the Gospel of John. In fact, John's Gospel is modeled upon the book of Genesis. That's why John's Gospel begins, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." He is deliberately mimicking Genesis 1:1. And what do we have? We have those first 18 verses operate as a prologue that kind of just sums up the whole narrative. And then he then tells the story of Jesus in the Gospel of John. The same thing is going on in Genesis 1 and 2. We do not have two creation accounts. What we have is the creation account of Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 1 in the 7 days of creation, these are a prologue that just gives an overview. And so one is not supposed to just read Genesis 1 and then Genesis 2 and try to figure out how do we reconcile these? Is Genesis 2 the sixth day? That's really not treating Genesis 1 and 2 the way I think the original author intended for us to. We're to understand Genesis 1, the way we have it spelled out, is an overarching grand narrative that the God of Israel is not just a local parochial deity, but that he is indeed the God who created everything, the heavens and the earth. That's why in Genesis 2, you have where God is referred to in a unique way that we find only one other place in the Pentateuch, where he's called the Lord God, Elohim Yehovah. Why is he doing that? He's putting the two together. Israel's God is the God who created all things. And that is how we're to understand Genesis 1.
And if you want to hear more from Ken Keithley, visit Reasons to Believe's YouTube channel and search for Ken Keithley. Now it's time for Culture Talk. This is the segment where we talk about culturally relevant topics, everything from books and films to issues that you'll come across on social media and in everyday conversations. Joining me today is astronomer Hugh Ross, and we have special guests, Yubnub and Falcor, my little puppies. They're going to be joining us as we talk about an important question, something called soulish animals. So when we think about animals today, especially, they've kind of been elevated to like family members. And it seems like that makes sense from a naturalistic perspective if humans and animals are only different in slight ways, but there isn't a significant difference. So how can we understand animals like our furry friends, but from a Christian perspective?
Well, Genesis talks about God creating three distinct kinds of light: light that's purely physical, light that's physical and soulish, like these two creatures, and then like you and I, we are uniquely body, soul, and spirit. And so we share the soulishness with these animals. They have mind, will, and emotions, but they lack spirit. They lack symbolic capability. They lack the capacity to communicate with God. Notice that God designed these creatures to bond and relate to us, a higher species. He designed you and me to relate to a higher being, God himself, which he didn't design these creatures to do. They have no God awareness, but they're certainly aware of you.
Yes. Yes, definitely. So then as we think of these pets and these animals from a Christian perspective, kind of the response from maybe someone who isn't a believer is that it might seem like it's a little bit maybe like we're disregarding animals, and because they're not exceptional, like how we say human exceptionalism, because animals aren't exceptional, then maybe Christians don't treat animals as they should.
Well, Job 12 addresses that. Job says, look to the beasts of the field, they'll teach you. Look to the birds of the sky, they'll instruct you. And what he was talking about is how God designed these higher animals to teach us important spiritual lessons. I already mentioned, they were designed to serve and please a higher species. We are designed to serve and please a higher being. As our sin causes these creatures to run away from us and be afraid of us, likewise, our sin causes us to run away from God and to be afraid of him. But if you take the sin factor out, you see that we're naturally drawn towards God. Take the sin factor away, you see these creatures are naturally drawn to us. I mean, look at this little thing.
I know, she loves you. Well, you're kind of like an animal whisperer, because animals tend to just gravitate toward you and flock to you, even out in the wild. So can you give just some tips on how we might build bridges between non-believers as we talk about animals and talk about our love for our furry friends? Like, how can we use this connection that we have to build bridges with non-believers?
I think it's important to expose our unbelieving friends to animals that have not been abused by human beings. Mm. I like to take people out into the wilds where they can meet these animals that have had no contact with humans, and you can see how they're naturally drawn to you. They want to come to you. They want to bond to you. They want to serve and please you. And they just ask the question, where did that come from? And what does that tell us about ourselves and our relationship with God? That's the beginning. If you look at the book of Job, it gives you about six different spiritual lessons we can glean. Notice it takes a higher being to tame these animals. Likewise, it takes a higher being to tame us.
Maybe I'm not quite high enough because I'm still trying with this one to tame her. But you've mentioned Job quite a bit, and you've actually written about this topic in your book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. So can you give us some other gems from this book?
Well, there's a number of scientific experiments that have been done on these animals, and namely, are they moral like we are? Numerous experiments established no, they are not. They're not sinners. They have no response to a moral law, but we do. Also, experiments done on their capabilities. We alone amongst all animals have symbolic capability, ability to develop language, mathematics. I mean, I don't think you're going to be able to teach calculus to this little creature.
Yeah. So. Well, thank you so much for that, Hugh. So again, thanks. And thank you, Yebnub and Falkor, for joining us. So if you want to hear more from Dr. Hugh Ross, check out his book on reasons.org. It is Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. Now we're going to go see what Jeff is up to with Give and Take.
Hello, welcome again to Give and Take, where we look at the latest scientific issues to help equip you to be able to share the gospel with confidence. And today I'm joined by Fuzz Rana and AJ Roberts, and we're going to tackle an important question. The idea that if the heavens declare the glory of God, why are so many scientists atheists? Fuzz, AJ, good to have you here today.
Jeff. Thanks, Jeff.
So, you know, I kind of hear this claim where there's this kind of pervasive idea that, you know, from the Christians, we know that they're, from the Bible, we know that the heavens declare the glory of God, but yet it seems like all the scientists are atheists. So how do we, what do we do with this claim that if the heavens declare the glory of God, that all these scientists are atheists?
Yeah, I think it's a claim that's not really substantiated by the scientists that I know.
How so? Flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah, so I think most of the people that I know in science, if they have a basic faith, it's just something that doesn't sort of enter into the scientific process or the discussions. And so they kind of keep their scientific work independent from their religious beliefs. And
so does that mean that they may or may not be religious, but that just doesn't play into their science? Or does that mean that they typically aren't religious and so they just separate the two?
Yeah, I think it's that they may or may not be.
Okay.
And if you want to get down to how many people have a faith and how many people don't have a faith and what faith do they have, then I think maybe I might punt to somebody like Elaine Eklund, who wrote the book, you know, Science Versus Religion, and she's talking about how even people who say that they don't have a belief in God still have some sort of spiritual sense from time to time, either when they're doing their work or they're out in nature. So
there's kind of a religious nature to it, even if they may claim that they don't believe in a God, if you will.
For many, there are.
Okay.
Yeah, I think
yeah,
so.
I mean, if you look at the survey data, depending on the discipline, but roughly about 30 to 35% of scientists will express belief in a personal God, and another 15% would express belief in a higher power. And so at most, you're looking at maybe 50% of scientists being atheists in that sense. And my experience, when you engage many of those scientists, oftentimes they will, by default, identify themselves as atheists, but they haven't really thought about.
So what do you mean by default there?
So in other words, if you present to these scientists evidence for God's existence from science, they would oftentimes say, that's just a theological observation. I don't think about theology. I'm a scientist.
So that would kind of go to AJ's point that there's these kind of two separate realms that people almost work
right.
in.
Right, yeah. And a lot of times they don't think about it. But I would agree with AJ. In my experience as a biochemist, it was routine for my colleagues when I was working in university labs or in industry labs to marvel at the nature of the cell's chemistry. This is amazing. This is cool. Mm-hmm. It was almost a religious response. So, you know, I think scientists do have that religious or spiritual orientation to nature. But they still might identify themselves as atheists.
Yeah, I don't know the statistics well enough to comment on Fuzz's reference to them, but to me it seems like, you know, sort of atheism by default is still sort of overstating the reality of my experience with my colleagues, right? I would say many of them, like Fuzz said, are philosophically just not sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you actually start to talk to them, you know, maybe over a break or a lunch or something, then you actually find out they're pretty agnostic. You know, they sort of have this, I haven't really thought about it. It's not really mm-hmm. part of my daily routine. So,
yeah, you know, and I find that, you know, one thing to help people like that get beyond this idea that that's theology, I just don't think about it, I just focus on science, is to start to ask them things that deal with the ultimate nature of reality. Mm-hmm. You know, start to ask them more philosophically oriented questions, and what do you think about this? And just to try to get them to start thinking in those terms. Mm-hmm. And I find that oftentimes they are more than willing to engage in some pretty intense but I think open conversations about those issues. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You just have to get their interest piqued.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I want to come back and, you know, that's kind of where I want to end is, you know, what can we do to help engage or help be able to engage people well? And, you know, it seems to me there's some of them that they just don't want to think of or haven't really thought about it much. Others who that's just a different realm. But there's also there. I mean, there are a number of scientists who are just legitimate atheists that they say there is no God. And some would claim that there's no scientific evidence. And, you know, there's often a claim that circulates in the church. And I think we've probably made it here at RTB to some extent that a lot of times that's just trying to avoid a personal rebellion or living in rebellion against God. What do we do with that?
I mean, I think there are scientists who have made those kind of statements. Some of them are prominent. Mm-hmm. But I think we want to be very careful to make sweeping generalizations.
That's
that
right.
Just because there are some outspoken atheists that have co-opted science in that way, that reflects everybody who's in the scientific community, because that's definitely not true.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience. I mean, there are occasional people I've run that are just rebellious or outspoken, but a lot of times it's more reflective, thoughtful, and are willing to engage in conversations
If you're reaching out to somebody who's a scientist or is scientifically minded, one thing that you must avoid doing is drawing conclusions with a high degree of confidence.
Yes.
If you say, for example, the scientific evidence indicates that God must exist, scientists will push back against that just on principle alone.
Yes.
But if you say...
I can relate to that.
Yes. But if you say that the scientific data is consistent with God's existence or is in harmony with God's existence or doesn't challenge God's existence,
that's so true. Yeah.
Then you'll have a very different conversation.
Yeah.
So you have to... People have to be aware that maybe sometimes the resistance to the evidence isn't that the evidence is lacking or that person is hard-hearted. It's just your approach hasn't been sensitive to how scientists react to absolute statements.
So beyond just being sensitive to the absolute statements, what other things can we do? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of things you got to pay attention to. And
well, I think what's really critical is that you don't react to the statement, right? You're not going to sort of reason your way to getting them to think differently. So don't respond so much to their assertion. Respond to the person, right? And I think the way you respond to the person is you ask questions. Mm. You know, so if you're an atheist and you just made this statement that you made earlier, you know, a very appropriate way I think to respond would be, well, that's really interesting. What's led you to such firm beliefs?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because then I'm starting to respond to the person and I'm going to invite them to start to articulate what's important to them. And that's going to help me understand, are they coming at this because they don't want a God that's going to tell them how to live their lives? Or have they really thought through this and they're just convinced, you know, maybe it's a problem of evil for them and not a problem of personal autonomy, right? So
it's really just kind of about building relationships with the person, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, and I find that to be a tremendously freeing thing because there's lots of reasons why people may not think about God or say God doesn't exist or just not even want to think about God. But as we engage in relationship, as we ask questions, as we explore why are they interested in God or have they thought about this, we're able to have conversations about the gospel, bring who Christ is and what the Bible has to say about things into those conversations in a way that invites conversations where we're sharing the gospel and allowing God to do the work of changing the heart. And that's what we're called to do. Now, we're going to go over to Monica to hear about RTB's student mentoring program called The Lab.
Hey guys, I'm Monica Jones, and today I'm talking to Krista Bontrager. She is RTB's Dean of Education. So let's talk The Lab.
Okay.
This is RTB's student mentorship program. I know that you were a part of the team that kind of created this.
Yeah.
First, tell me what was your passion for, you know, just thinking about this type of program?
Yeah. So one day I was online and I was reading a blog post from another ministry where a very prominent person in apologetics was actually encouraging Christian parents to adopt a strategy of discouraging their children who are interested in science from not going into science. Mm. And it really kind of broke my heart.
Yeah.
Like, okay, let's tease this strategy out a little bit. Like, let's say some percentage of Christian parents adopt this strategy. Where are we going to be in 5 to 10 years? And I thought, man, some of the most critical cultural conversations we're having involve scientific questions. We want Christians to be at that table.
That.
But if we haven't earned our way to the table, we're going to be left out.
Right.
And so then I was praying about it, and I felt like the Lord was showing me a picture of what would happen if we reversed that, like we turned it upside down, where we actually encouraged Christian young people to go into science.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's kind of an interesting idea. So sat down with Jeff Swearing and Katie Galloway and started brainstorming, and that's kind of part of the vision behind the lab is how can we empower and encourage Christian students to go into a high-tech field, engineering, mathematics, medicine, or science.
All right, so I know students are involved in this, but parents, are they required to come? What does that really look like for them?
Sure, and that's a big component that I think is really special about the lab. Both the lead mentors, Katie Galloway and Jeff Swearing, their parents played pivotal roles in their journey to science. But what's interesting is they both have very different stories. Jeff's dad was a chemist, and he was able to guide Jeff toward science in a way, like as an insider. He knew how to show him how to get a mentor and everything. Katie's parents just knew they had an amazingly talented daughter. They're blue-collar people, but they found resources for her. They got her connected with reasons to believe. And I think that that's really the vision of the lab is it's okay if you are not a scientist and you don't have a scientific background as a parent, but you recognize God has given my child a very special gift. How can I come alongside them and be their cheerleader and encourage them? So having parents come to the lab, it's not required because college students, when you're in that season, I have a college student now, there's not many opportunities for me and my college-age daughter to hang out together. But this is a very unique journey that they can take together and come to the lab. The parents can get equipped on how to be that cheerleader for their student. The students get training and how to connect the dots between their future career and their faith.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you, Krista.
Yeah.
And you know what? You might not have a college student at home. You may know somebody who loves science and could benefit from the lab. So I encourage you to check it out. Go to our website, reasons.org. You'll click on education, and then to the right, there's a tab called the lab, and it'll give you all the information that you need. Well, I thank you for joining us, and I hope to see some of you at the lab.
Once again, if you want to find out more about RTB's student mentoring program, we are now accepting applications. Just go to reasons.org/the lab. Well, that about does it for us today. We want to thank you for joining us this week on 2819.
And you know, again, we hope that you've watched the show with sharing the gospel in mind. So we hope that we've inspired you to step into conversations about your faith and do so with confidence and compassion.
Yeah, that's really what you and I, every week we talk about the show. We're really just trying to help inspire you to take those next steps toward the people that God has supernaturally and strategically placed in your life.
And this show is made possible through the faithful support of Reasons to Believe donors. So if you feel led to support resources like this, please visit reasons.org/2819.
Until next time, check us out on the web at reasons.org. So many great resources waiting for you there to explore. Our scholar blog posts, articles, podcasts, all there to help you explore God's world and God's word.
And you'll also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at 2819 Show. Give us a like, follow us. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll see you next week.